It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name's Kurt Frankum. As many of you know, if you're new to the podcast, I welcome you. What we do here is I get in front of this microphone, and then we interview prolific leaders, whether they think so or not, across the church, and talk about how they lead in their calling, what they do, what tactics they use, what technologies they use that really help them do their job well. And it's definitely one of the more favorite segments on the podcast, because the others are just me like spouting my opinion, and really nobody wants to hear that, but it's my website, so I guess I get to put it up there. But feel free to contribute any negative comments to those posts, and I'm gladly open to your feedback. Anyways, how I lead interview, this is what we do here. And today we have a great opportunity to talk with Sean Hammond. Sean Hammond is actually, I don't know if I'd call him a mission buddy, but we were in the same mission about the same time. I was about a year ahead of him. We didn't really know each other, but we recognized each other, and he stumbled across Leading LDS, and I convinced him to talk with me for about an hour about how he leads, and it turned out to be a fantastic interview. He's in Colorado Springs, and we talk about everything from, you know, tactics he uses to simply reach out to the one and minister to the one, and even we got on the topic of how to deal with tough circumstances of tragedy in a ward where, you know, a family loses loved ones, and his experience of going through that, and really tough situations that, again, bishops will wake up and think, I didn't sign up for this, but nonetheless, you're the man for the job and have to jump to it and support and love in any way possible. So here is my interview with Bishop Sean Hammond. How are you, Sean?
I'm doing well, Kurt. How are you doing?
Good. Now, you're calling in all the way from Colorado Springs, right?
That's right. Yeah. Down in Colorado Springs, been here a few years, and love it here.
Nice. And what is it you do down there that makes yourself a living?
So I work for a healthcare company down here as an internal process improvement consultant.
Sounds technical.
Help people be more efficient. Not as much as you think.
So, and that deals with, you're telling me before we hit record, that deals with all the, like, the lean system, Six Sigma stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think that's pretty, I'm sure you take some of those principles and apply them from time to time to your church work.
I do. I try to. I've been doing this for a couple of years, and it's really been a good, it's helped me kind of open my eyes to some of the things that we do within the ward and help in a lot of ways.
Cool. Now, just for people who aren't familiar, and I'm not overly familiar, other than I know that those are certifications and systems that companies use to increase efficiency, right?
Yeah.
And how else would you articulate what that is?
So efficiency is a good word to use kind of within the manufacturing industry. In healthcare, it also focuses on like safety and quality and those sorts of things as well. But definitely helps departments and companies be more efficient. You got
right on. Now, give us a little background on your, a little information about your background. One thing that I guess we should mention is we served our mission together. We didn't really know each other. I was a Spanish missionary about a year ahead of you, and you were you an English-speaking missionary?
So I was called as an English-speaking missionary, and then with 6 months left in my mission, I got the most bizarre phone call I've received. Switching me over to the Spanish program as his own leader in Spanish for the Spanish missionaries. So, kind of a bizarre experience.
So you got thrown into the Spanish language for a few months?
I did a little bit. There were a lot of really young missionaries, a lot of from native countries who might not have seen had a lot of good examples of leadership. And so my responsibility was essentially to train some of the younger missionaries to be leaders in the mission. So it was a really special experience.
Oh, interesting. Right on. Yeah, and so you came across Leading LDS a while back and just happened to know it was a fellow Sacramento missionary that was the editor here.
Yeah, that's right.
Cool. Right, and so before your mission, maybe give us your background, your upbringing in the church, or were you born in the church, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I was born in Blackfoot, Idaho. So about, kind of Provo north a little bit. So definitely both my parents were active growing up. We moved to Michigan for a few years when I was really young, but the majority of my youth was spent in Colorado, in the Denver area. And so that's kind of where I've lived. But yeah, my dad was high counselor and then a bishop when I was a youth. After, I think it was right after I got home from my mission, or maybe while I was on my mission, my dad was called into the state presidency. My mom's been a seminary teacher and young women's president and women's society president. So I kind of grew up with the gospel in my home and consider that a great blessing.
Cool. And then you attended BYU after your mission? Graduated from there?
Yep. Okay. Went to BYU for a year at BYU and then left on my mission and came back and graduated from there. So.
Cool. And how would you describe the phase of life that you're in at this point?
We're a young couple. We have a 9-year-old who just had her birthday, and a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. So we've just got young kids. I'm about the same age as you, so early 30s and early in my career. And just kind of still trying to kind of figure out what I'm doing with my life.
Cool. And currently in your ward, how long have you served as the bishop?
I just hit my 3-year mark. So
nice. So you've got it figured out. I'm glad we're talking to you.
I don't think it ever happens, but starting to hit some stride on a few things, I think. So
good.
People kind of mentioned that three and a half years is when you start to feel like maybe you're getting some things. And I like to think I'm starting to get there a little bit, but still every day is a new experience as a bishop.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, how would you describe the demographic of your ward, the characteristics of your ward, to kind of get an idea of what you face as a bishop week in and week out?
Sure. So a pretty big ward. We have about 600 members on our rolls, and our activity is probably about average. We give a little over 200 to sacrament meeting on any given Sunday, it's a lot of work to do, a lot of opportunities to help people. It's a pretty eclectic ward in terms of kind of socioeconomic and educational background. We have some pretty wealthy people, CEOs and lawyers and doctors, and we also have those who really struggle. And we have a lot of older people in our ward. We also have a lot of young families and everything in between. So pretty diverse in terms of those areas.
Nice. And so how would you describe the youth? Do you have a large youth, large primary?
I would say it's probably below average in terms of the size. I think right around 20 or 25 and young men and the same in young women. A few less young women. It's about average and a few less than that that are active, but really wonderful youth. I just love the youth in our work.
Cool. Right on. Now, you were the, I think you mentioned you're the young men's president prior to your call as bishop, right?
Yeah, I was young men's president for a couple of years prior to my call, and it was really a special experience. I think it's a neat calling to have before being called as a bishop, because you really gain a love for those youth, which I think is just so important with the calling as a bishop.
Yeah, and how would you, maybe tell us the story of how you were called as bishop. Was it something, obviously nobody ever really expects it, but did you know the change was coming?
No, not at all. So I was sitting in sacrament meeting. My family was actually out of town visiting my wife's family. So I was sitting alone in sacrament meeting. Afterwards, the state executive secretary who's in our ward grabbed me and told me that the state president wanted to see me on that Thursday. So I had I had no idea what it was about. He didn't mention bringing my wife. So I was trying to figure out what a state president calls people in for without a spouse, and kind of those thoughts that go through your head about what's going on. So
Yeah.
And I thought there was a bishop, actually the other ward in our building, who had been killed in an accident a month or two previous to that.
Oh my goodness.
The bishop who was called to replace him was from the High Council. And so I thought, I was completely overwhelmed with the thought that perhaps I would be called to the High Council and everything that goes with that, and, you know, being made a high priest. And so I was a little bit overwhelmed. But anyway, went into the interview, and he asked me if there's, I believe all he asked is if there was anything that would keep me from holding a temple recommend. And when I said no, he says, I've received permission from the first presidency. And that sentence kind of came out in slow motion, and I was trying to figure out what a stake president would need to talk to the first presidency about as it related to me in my life.
And, sure.
He continued by saying to call you as the Bishop of the Mountain Shadows Ward. And my jaw really hit the floor. It was not on my radar. The bishop who had been serving at the time had been serving for about 3.5 years and ended up moving pretty soon after. So I didn't know that. And so it was really, it wasn't even close to on my mind. It was the Thursday before General Conference. So I had about a week and a half before I was sustained, and, you know, a lot of sleepless nights and wet pillowcases as I was contemplating the call and the people and some of the situations that I might encounter as a bishop.
Cool. And so that was 3 years ago.
That's right. Yeah, almost exactly.
And so did you say your wife did come with you to that appointment?
No, she didn't know. She was actually participating in the Pathway program, and Thursday night is when they were meeting. So she was in a different building with that program. And as soon as I left, I texted her and told her to call me immediately. And we had that phone call. Really a surprising experience. But looking back, really, it's been such a huge blessing in my life and for my family.
Nice. Now, did you have much interaction with the previous bishop leading up to the call, other than obviously serving as the young men's president? Did you have a lot to go off of since you weren't necessarily the bishopric?
Not really. I mean, I work closely with him, and I consider him really a mentor. Not specifically as it relates to being a bishop, other than what I just observed. I mean, he was just such a humble man. Different than I am, but I just learned so much from him. But yeah, I mean, we had about maybe a half hour meeting, kind of as a handoff, and he gave me a folder with some notes and different things in it, and essentially said, best of luck to you. And I really appreciated that way. I know you've had an episode in the past talking about kind of the leadership vacuum and different ways you can handle that. And I kind of appreciated, you know, I knew who he was working with and, you know, some of the people that were in church discipline and people on welfare, but I didn't know a lot of specifics, and a lot of it I just kind of had to pick up as I met with people. And I appreciated that. I didn't really have any preconceived notions, and learned a lot in those first few months.
Cool. Now, and what, when you kind of, you mentioned before that you sort of settled into it, or you're kind of in stride with some responsibilities.
I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but
I'm just curious, like what responsibilities were like maybe more difficult at the beginning, but now you're able to handle with a bit more confidence?
One of them, and this has taken me a long time, and I still have so much more with it, but is as it relates to welfare. You know, there's just so little guidance that's given to you, and that's on purpose. You really have to learn to follow the Spirit and be able to have the spirit of discernment. So that's one way. And then also as it relates to our responsibility as a common judge, and you really need to be an instrument in the hands of the Lord. You stand in His place and you represent Him, and that's a heavy responsibility. And I think there's some, it takes some practice, frankly, and that's okay. But I feel like I'm getting better in my counseling and those responsibilities.
Cool. And so you mentioned the name of your ward is Mountain Shadows.
The Mountain Shadows Ward, yeah.
It's funny because we have in my ward, there's an apartment complex called Mountain Shadows. So
interesting.
It caught me off guard, like, yeah. Wait a minute. That's cool. All right, so let's jump into your five key leadership principles. As most listeners know, whenever I do a How I Lead interview, I ask those that I interview just beforehand to think and write down some principles of leadership that they feel like have that they're always relying on, or that they have impacted them, or that they look back and think, man, I wish I would have done this earlier. Mm-hmm. And so, and you've done that very well. The first one you wrote was, it really is about the one. Expound on that.
Yeah, I think in one way or another, most people that you interview have that on there, and you know, to some degree. You look at a bishop and everything that he does, and you see him up on the stand, and he's overlooking, you know, the whole congregation, and that's a responsibility, and that's true. But the real impact that he has is in the one-on-one interactions that he has with the members. And there's kind of a lot that falls under that. When I was called in my interview, when I was called as a bishop, my state president said that my success as a bishop would be directly correlated with my ability to get into the homes of the members. And I think that really speaks to that idea of it being about the one. It's those private, individual interactions that you have. And whether it's in the home, or whether it's in your office, or at the grocery store when you see one of the members, or whatever it might be, I really think that it really is about ministering to the individual. And even when you're speaking to the ward, you're doing it with the idea that there are a bunch of ones, a bunch of individuals who are listening to you, and you're ministering to them individually as you're speaking. Sometimes as I write, you know, talks, as far as I'm in firesides, I may even, you know, in my own mind, think I'm speaking to this member. And anybody else who gets anything from it, that's great, but this is one for this person. And so that's really the way I like to lead. And I've had some sacred experiences as I've interacted with people on that level. And part of that too is being able to, it's following the promptings of the Holy Ghost to know when you need to stop by someone's house or give somebody a phone call. Or, you know, President Monson shares a story, I think in his book, about the man who was in the hospital. And he was in a leadership, President Monson was in a leadership meeting as a bishop, and he felt the prompting to go visit him, and he kept pushing it off until eventually he said, okay, fine, I'll go. And as he got there, I think it was a nurse that came to him and said, you know, brother so-and-so was calling for Bishop Monson as he was passing away. And he promised himself there that he would never ignore the promptings of the Spirit. And what a great lesson to learn. And that's the way President Monson lived his life, as you hear his stories and the way that he's ministered to the one. I think it's a great example to all of us of the way to follow the Spirit in your interactions with individual members of whatever your responsibilities are.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point as far as following the Spirit and just being sensitive to the individuals around you and the ward that may need something from you. Is there anything like, outside of just thinking like specific tactics that you work into your life as habits to make sure that you're always focusing on the one? Because I know that being in that calling can be very administrative at points, and you kind of can get lost in that. So is there anything you do to just kind of check yourself to make sure you're still reaching out to the one? Anything coming to mind?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it leads into kind of a story I was hoping to share. Part of it, I think, is your councils, both as a bishopric, your ward council in PUC, is being able to identify what is it that I, as a bishop, need to be there for? What do I need to do? And the handbook gives some instruction on that, but the Spirit, I think, is a better resource in terms of when you should be there. But getting some feedback from the bishopric and the work council with regard to specific situations, I think is really helpful. One example I wanted to share is, we've had kind of a tough year as a ward. We've had several people pass away, and a few of those have been in kind of tragic circumstances. And we had a father and a son who passed away in a camping accident, just a few months ago. And it was several hours away from where we're at. And that night I had a PPI with my elders forum president. And he asked me if I was going to go up there to be with the family as they were up there with, dealing with everything that they had to deal with. And I simply asked him, what do you think I should do? And we had a special experience as we felt the Spirit, because I had been wrestling with, you know, do I go up there? Do I need to leave them some time alone? Do I need to be there? And we had the Spirit in front of both of us that was a situation where I needed to be there. And so my wife and I left early the next morning, and we were able to spend really a special day with that family, as we with wife and children, two of which were with them at the time. And it was a really special experience. And I was thankful for that conversation I had with my eldest one president for the council he gave me as his bishop. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities like that to utilize the people around you who are also incredible people close to the Spirit. And so that's probably the biggest thing. But also just being in tune with the Spirit on your own, living your life in a way that the Spirit can speak to you, even in situations, you know, at work or on your, you know, while you're driving home, or sometimes it's in kind of the situations when you don't expect it to happen and the Spirit speaks to you in strongest.
Yeah. Now, I obviously don't want to spend too much time on that issue just because that experience, just because it's very sensitive, and I can't imagine the emotions that not only a bishop goes through, but a family and trying to be there for support. But one thing I've often thought about as far as creating some information on Leading LDS is because I've heard various stories where you know, somebody in a family is tragically taken, and it's the stake president or the bishop who has to go deliver that news or be there, you know, and or you hear about an instance on TV and they're interviewing the bishop, you know, as sort of the family spokesman for that moment. Looking back on that scenario or anything similar to it, any advice, like, and obviously I would guess in those situations, you're just sort of flying by the Spirit where, you know, you just have prompting after prompting what you're supposed to do. But anything like, I'm just thinking, is there specific resources you wish you would have known more about? Is there a different approach you would have taken in hindsight? Anything else to add in that context?
So as it relates to the media specifically, and there have been a couple of situations where we've been involved in the past, 6 or 7 months, we have a member of our ward who actually is a member of the media. And so I've actually... He's one of our high priests. He's in the high priest group leadership. And I relied actually a lot upon him and his advice to me as to how to interact with them. So I haven't specifically interacted with the media. The family has kind of taken that, and they have some really strong members, a brother of the wife, who's really strong and helpful there. But if you do know anybody in the media and you are expected to, you know, you're asked by the family to do that, I would try to get some advice from them. Or for sure, before talking with the media, I would counsel with your stake president. And in fact, I talked with my stake president before agreeing to do this. And, I would just be very careful. I was actually surprised. And the media is doing their job. They have some important things they need to do. And they take their responsibility seriously. And sometimes that isn't with the greatest amount of sensitivity as it relates to the family. And so getting as much advice and counsel before you do that is really important.
Yeah, for sure. And then anything outside as far as the interaction with the media, as far as like supporting the family, interacting with them, and maybe it's just simply being available to them.
Yeah, and that's really it. Each situation is so different as it relates to their family. Yeah. Some of the families, they need to hear from me every day and kind of give them that support. They need to be at the house at least on a weekly basis to get that support. And some of them want more space and they want you to, they want to know that you're there to support them, but they have loving friends and family and relationships with them and really would prefer just to kind of spend that time with them. So I don't think there's a right or a wrong way to do it, except that you follow the Spirit.
Yeah, for sure. And I just think that in those situations, there's never time to like go to the internet and find the perfect article, you know, on Leading LDS that somebody's written about how to handle these situations. Yeah. And so my hope is that, you know, if this happens to another leader, maybe they can fall back on your words and your experience and gain something from that. So that's why I ask. But anyways, great experience and obviously a great example of remembering the one and the individual and ministering rather than just being the guy that counts the tithing on the weekend. So
exactly right. Yeah.
All right, the next one you put down is, we must develop the capacity. Obviously, this is a quote from President Monson. We must develop the capacity to see men not as they are at the present, but as they may become when they receive testimonies of the gospel of Christ.
Yeah, I love this principle, and it's something that kind of really hit me as I serve the mission. I think most missionaries have this kind of revelation to them as a meeting with investigators, and it might be the guy with the ponytail and the earring and the beard and the tattoos, and you look at them and you just say, you know what, you would make a fantastic young men's president. And you can kind of see them as they can become, as they accept the doctrines of the gospel. I've heard several people on your podcast mention that. Al and Jeff a couple of podcasts ago mentioned that, and I totally agree with the thoughts that they shared. But I have that as a missionary. I had it again, actually, before I was called as the young men's president. We were on a youth conference. It was a backpacking trip. And on that backpacking trip, I had that same experience. It was about 2 weeks before I was called the young men's president, where I would look at these youth and just say, you have incredible opportunities ahead of you in this church. And if you just stay close and just, hold to the iron rod, you could do so much. And as a young men's president, I saw, felt that all the time. And then never as strongly as I felt it as a bishop. And as you work with people who are struggling, or as you have people who are coming back to church, and we've had a lot of great success with that, or investigators that come to church. If you can just love people because of the potential that you see in them, and if you can see them the way that God sees them, then I think it helps you minister to those people a lot better. I think it's a really important principle to be able to do that. And it helps as you're extending callings too. So don't extend callings just because there's somebody who's the most successful businessman or attorney or whatever it might be, but find opportunities for people to learn and to grow because you see that potential in them as the Spirit reveals that to you.
Yeah, I'm glad you added that at the end. That's what I was thinking. Is I remember many instances where, as a bishop, we were figuring out whatever calling it was, Sunday school president, or a instructor in a relief society or whatever, and a name would come to us, and we'd all kind of just dismiss it like immediately, like, oh no, that person just. I can give you 10 reasons why that won't work.
Right.
But sometimes it was good to step back and just say, why don't we try? I mean, what's the worst that can happen? Even if that person doesn't show up, or, we can step in and help and do it, but maybe that'll be the difference maker and help them grow. And definitely callings, and I've seen it myself, that, somebody rolled the dice with me one day and called me to a bishopric. And because of that opportunity, I've grown so much individually. And
right.
I think as we see people as how they can become, that those opportunities open up, and it sure is easier to staff a ward when you're not so picky.
And then I think you really see a lot of miracles happen as you can help others recognize that in themselves as well. So you see it in them, but then for you to help them understand, listen, you're struggling and we're helping you through some things, but, Heavenly Father knows you and loves you, you've got a lot of potential. You can do a lot of great things for this church. You can change. Elder Hallstrom gave a talk I think it was last April, called What Manner of Men? And he told the story about a man he met with the bishop who said, I have a temper and that's just the way I am. And he talked about how when we say that about ourselves, we really are just kind of putting up the white flag and giving up. And I think a big responsibility of a bishop is to be able to help people understand their potential, that they can change, and that they can, become a powerful tool in the hands of the Lord.
Yeah, and I've seen that spirit diminish a lot when I spoke with people in deeply in some form of an addiction. They get so frustrated with themselves. They feel like, this is just how I'm going to be, and taking the opportunity to really encourage them to say, I have no doubt that you're someone greater, and that you can overcome this through, the powers of Christ and And so great, great principle for sure. The next one you mentioned is don't be satisfied just doing things the way others in similar positions do them. I love this.
Yeah. So this actually comes, and I kind of hesitate to share this, but this is actually something that was taught to me in my patriarchal blessing. It was something that was shared in my patriarchal blessing. I thought a lot about that. I didn't get it as a kid, but now that I've had some responsibilities, I understand that. It's easy to do that. And, you know, maybe for the first couple months in a calling, you can kind of just try to keep the boat floating. You know what I mean? And you just kind of try to keep things going a little bit, but you should really try to quickly get into the point where you can, allow the Lord to use you and your talents, your spiritual gifts, that may be very different from the previous bishop or, you know, previous Marine Society president or whatever it might be. And he intends to use you differently than that person. I mentioned, you know, my previous bishop was a successful attorney. He was older. He had kids older than me. And a wonderful man, and I loved him, but we were different. And it's easy as you start to kind of be overwhelmed, thinking I need to try to be just like, you know, Bishop so-and-so. But you're really doing yourself a disservice as you do that, and also the members of your ward, because you're not allowing the Lord to use your specific talents. I saw this again. About a year and a half ago, we had a change in our state presidency. And our previous state president would recognize his last name as the son of an apostle, and it's just a spiritual giant. He knew so much and kind of just brought an incredible power into the room. And it was really a blessing to serve under him. And as it became obvious that there was going to be a change, I remember personally feeling a huge weight, you know, as I was involved in the interviews with the general authority, thinking, my goodness, the person who replaces this state president, I don't know what they're going to do. He was just a fantastic state president. It was his second time serving as a state president. And so he was an incredible man. But I remember when they announced, the sustaining state president, and I knew him well. He was a previous bishop in the state, and he was interacted a lot. I just felt the Spirit so strongly about the kind of state president he would be. And it's completely different than the previous state president. He has different skills. His ability to show love and concern for individuals is just unbelievable. Just a great testimony of the atonement of Christ. He's a quieter person than was the previous state president. They're just really different. But both of them, I think, are just incredible leaders. And I've learned, I consider both of them mentors to me. I have appreciated serving under both of them. But I'm so thankful that the new state president didn't try to be a cookie cutter of the previous state president. He would have failed at that. I think a lot of missionaries see that if they serve during a change in a mission president, where the new mission president is very different than the previous one. It's not that anyone's doing anything wrong. It's that the Lord's utilizing people with their unique talents, their spiritual gifts that they're blessed with from the Spirit, to be able to have an impact the way that the Lord wants to have an impact on whoever they have stewardship over.
Yeah, that's a great point, and it makes me think about the transition I've just been through with the state presidency that, the previous state president and his counselors, we, as a bishop, I absolutely loved working with them. They were very effective. And the new state president, who was also a bishop prior to his call, he felt the same way. He loved working with them. They're great leaders. And then when we heard there was going to be a change, we both of us were very concerned about who the new guy was going to be, yeah. Right? And suddenly we find ourselves in their place. And now we're approaching activities and programs that they approached. And our initial thought is, well, we'll just do it like them. But it makes us, we've been pushing ourselves to pause for a minute and say, well, let's just step back and see what the handbook says. And maybe there's a different approach we could take that would, leverage our talents and abilities differently than theirs did. And in many instances, that's been the case. And it's turned out better, not because, you know, the previous presidency did anything wrong or we didn't like it, but, you know, we're just adjusting to fit the different personalities and approach it differently.
Yeah. And you mentioned this, the handbook, and the handbook really should be, you know, kind of an anchor point for all leaders.
Yeah.
But outside of that, you have a lot of leeway to do things different ways. Each ward is so different. Each elders quorum is different. And elite society is different. And so just trying to, you know, maybe follow the traditions that the ward has or way that it's always been done. That's just, I just don't think that's good enough unless the Spirit confirms to you that that's the way that you want it done. You need to be open to the problems of the Spirit.
Yeah, I think, you know, the first year of any leader, just spending time at and questioning the approach of everything. I mean, not like publicly, but, you know, to yourself and say, why did they do it like that? And again, going back to that anchor of the handbook and saying, well, this is what I have to do, or this is kind of the mark I have to meet, and how can we approach it differently? And I'm always shocked about the different things. I'm like, oh, that's not in the handbook. We just do it that way, you know?
So yeah, a lot of tradition in the church and you know, there's some benefit to that. And culturally, I think there's benefit to doing things similarly, but outside the handbook, your hands really aren't tied. You can really be creative and follow the promptings of the Spirit to do the things the way you want to, that the Lord wants it done.
Yeah, perfect. All right, next one you said is err on the side of mercy and compassion.
Yeah. And this, you know, anybody who served as a bishopric or counseling individually with people, I'm sure has some tender experiences. As it relates to this, both in matters of judgment and in matters of welfare. I don't know what else to say other than be slow to judge and quick to love. I remember when I was called as a bishop, my older brother had served as a bishop down in Miami, and he was up, he moved back to the Denver area, and I had lunch with him just to kind of talk about, you know, give you some advice. And one of the most important things he said was, when somebody comes and they confesses something to you, how much more powerful is it to you know, they're in tears and they feel so bad, and how much more power is there to just say, you know what, before we go on, I just want you to know that Heavenly Father loves you, that he knows the struggle you're facing. He knows you better than you know yourself, and he knows, as I mentioned earlier, he knows your potential, but he just loves you a lot. And as your bishop, I love you too. And then you can go on to you know, talking about the repentance process and what needs to happen and, you know, some of the restrictions that there may be and sometimes in a disciplinary council potentially. But how much more powerful to let the person know that you just love them and that anything that you do is going to be with the intention of helping them to repent. Helping them to have the Spirit within them. As it relates to welfare, you know, it's, I can't really be able to talk within the last couple of years about welfare, but it's easy to say that this person brought this upon themselves. I think the name of the talk actually was Are We Not All Beggars? And I felt
Elder
that,
Holland, I believe.
It was Elder Holland, that's right. But I've felt that powerfully too in matters of welfare. You know what? Who am I to judge how this person got into this situation? Obviously, there's a heavy responsibility as a bishop to know when to administer the sacred funds of the church. But in all situations, there's no reason not to show forth love and compassion towards the person. I think we have a responsibility to do that.
Perfect. And I think, you know, a big role that a bishop can play is playing the role of the validator, like helping them feel validated that, you know, it's okay to cry. It's okay to be hurt in these circumstances. It's okay to realize that we're all sinners, and it's okay to realize that you need the atonement as much as I need the atonement.
Right.
And there's, it's hard to validate through correction and sternness, right? But there's a lot of validation and mercy and compassion. And there's always time, you know, obviously there's a place for sternness and correction, but there's always time for that tomorrow. But today you might as well default to grace and mercy.
Yeah. I always default to section 121 of the Doctrine and Covenants as it relates to leadership. I can't remember the exact verses, but, you know, talking about correcting with sharpness, afterwards showing forth an influence or an increase in love. And so you're right, there's a time for correction and a time for sharpness, but I don't think there's ever a time for somebody to question the love that you have for them. And so by helping them understand that, maybe even before the correction happens, they can better understand that the correction is because of the love that you have for them, and as a representative of Christ and the love that he has for them.
Awesome. The last point you put is your most important calling isn't in the church, but in your home.
Yep. This is such a hard one to, I guess I should back up on all of these points. I think as I was trying to think of them, I thought of what would a really good bishop do, and on each one of them, I have so far to go. this is the case on this one too, and it's hard as a bishop because in so many callings that it just takes so much time. But it's really important to remember that your most important responsibility is your wife and your kids, and being a husband and a father. Some advice my brother gave me as well in a meeting was thinking of my life as a kind of a three-legged stool between work, church, and family. And so all three of those really are really, really important. And so there needs to be a balance. And if you put too much emphasis on any one of them, the stool is going to fall. But I do think that, personally, I think that the most important leg of that stool is my own family. That doesn't mean that there aren't situations where I have to step away from my family for something that really needs my attention. But never should my own children or my wife think that that my calling is more important than they are. And it's such a delicate balance, and there are different ways to ensure that happens. But making sure that you're going on dates with your wife and you're spending time one-on-one with your children is so critical. No success compensates for failure in the home. And that includes success in your church calling. Being a successful bishop isn't enough if you fail in the home because as a result of your lack of belief. And so it's so important that you're sensitive to how your wife and your children are doing spiritually and emotionally. And that you are very deliberate in the time that you spend with them. And part of that, too, is sometimes, inevitably, the amount of time you spend with them is going to be less when you have a calling like a bishop. But what can increase is the deliberateness of the time that you spend with them. And again, I say this as probably the worst person at this, but when you're with your family, you are with your family. That they know that you're there, that you love them, you're spending quality time with them. And I think that's something that has improved for me is I don't spend as much time with my family now, but I do think, and maybe you could ask my wife if that's true, but I do think that the quality of the time and the quality of my conversations with my family has improved immensely as we've tried to be more deliberate in the time that we spend.
Awesome. Yeah, and it makes me wonder, this is just sort of my gut feeling, but going back, if I went back and looked at the How I Lead interviews and the different points people have shared, it seems like on average, this concept is always one of them, is sort of this idea of stepping back and taking time for your personal life, work, and especially family. And I would add that it's important, as the bishop or the stake president, you're the guy that gets to call the shots, right? And the counselors can sometimes feel like if they don't go to a meeting or be there, when you ask for them to be there, that they've disappointed you and therefore they have not magnified their calling. And so I always try to make it a point to tell my counselors that, hey, if you're ever getting ready for a meeting and your wife walks in and kind of gives you that look like, I need you home tonight, or directly tells you that you have my permission to just not come, or just tell me you're not coming. And I don't even need like a super good excuse, like just the fact that you're focusing on your family, doing that, that's good enough for me, and we'll figure it out, at some point. And so, but great, great principle. All right. Well, now I generally, you mentioned you've had time in the past to serve as an Elders Quorum president, and that was your time at BYU. Is that right?
Yeah, it was my freshman year at BYU, the Uniform Mission. And it was an interesting, yeah, sorry about my cough, I'm coming over cold. So, but yeah, I was called as an elders quorum president, and my freshman ward was about probably 2 or 3 weeks after I had been ordained an elder in my freshman ward. And it was just another one of those calls, similar to my call as a bishop, where your jaw hits the floor and you wonder how in the world or what's the Lord thinking on this one. But it was, again, a really special experience for me.
Cool. Now, how would I spent some time in some BYU wards. I didn't go to BYU, but I was down in that area. Well, it's because they rejected me three times. It's sort of a sore topic. But anyways, but I was in various BYU wards, and I know that the home teaching is definitely unique there as far as, you know, everybody's the same person. Like, I'm just the college kid and I'm active because I'm going to BYU. And so, any reflections on home teaching, not only at that time, but even as your current calling, as you interact with elders quorum presidents and high priest group leaders?
Yeah. You know, there are some differences, but there's also a lot of similarities. I went in kind of maybe a bit naive as it relates to home teaching. I remember sitting in my first elders quorum presidency meeting, and I had my counselors there who I didn't know very well. And we sat down and I said, I have a goal for us, for our own teaching. I said, we're at BYU, we're all members of the church. And so our goal is 100% home teaching. And I figured, you know, everybody was just going to go out and do it. But I realized it didn't take very long for me to realize that home teaching is hard. Not that it's difficult to get in the car and drive and have a conversation with somebody, but people are busy and they have responsibilities. And college students are busy, and even if the person you're home teaching is on the floor above you or the building across the street, it's just really difficult. And you need to approach home teaching with a lot of love and understanding for the people who are doing it. But I also think it's so important. I just think home teaching, it's, as a bishop especially, you realize you can't be with everybody. You can't. You know, there are people even who are hurting, but you know, with 600 members in your ward, and several widows or people who are divorced, and there's just so many people that it's overwhelming as a bishop. And so the home teaching responsibility is so important. But all that considered, you need to really be compassionate as you're interacting with people regarding their home teaching. But yeah, it was a unique experience at BYU. I like to think we got a little bit better, but even at BYU, there's unique circumstances as it relates to that.
Yeah, for sure. So anything in your current ward that you, any tactic that your elders quorum president has tried or a new approach, or is it mainly, you know, you just sort of encourage and make sure the lists and routes are out?
I don't think there's necessarily, I don't think we're doing anything really unique as it relates to home teaching. We try to, you know, especially as it relates to new members or reactive members who are, you know, being reactivated. We like to, you know, have that conversation in our council or PBC about an interim approach to consider who that would be. We have a fairly large ward geographically as well. We are kind of on the far west side up against the mountains here in Colorado Springs. And we have some members who actually live up in the mountains, kind of the foothills of Pikes Peak. And from north to south, corner to corner, we're about an hour or so drive. And so you try to, you know, geographically, for those who, for whom that's an issue, you try to be mindful of the people who are on the degree. And also with, you know, age and interest, and I don't think that's anything that's a revelation to anybody who's trying to organize it. But we struggle, I think, just like the other ward does to do home teaching. In fact, I can't remember how I found your podcast, Kurt, but that might have been it. I might have been Googling home teaching ideas and came across maybe an episode. And we try to take things that we learned from here and implement different things. But it's a constant struggle.
Cool. Yeah. Well, let's talk about focusing back on specifically your calling as bishop. What's your typical week like, starting Sunday morning? all the way until Saturday night.
So, we have a bishopric meeting and senior work council every Sunday morning. We actually give fast Sunday off of those senior work council. But we have a 1 o'clock schedule now, so we don't start quite as early, but in about a month and a half, we'll be at the 9 o'clock schedule. So we'll start, we'll be at the church when it's still dark outside at 6:30 probably is when we'll start. And then interviews during the morning before, and then obviously the church block and interviews afterwards, hopefully not too long after church, because one becomes the family. Then I usually have 2 nights a week that I have specified for being with the youth or with for different interviews. I usually do those on Tuesday and Wednesday nights. Some Thursday nights we spend with ministry visits. And that's something else we need to be better at, but that Thursday night sometimes is used for that as a bishopric. But then obviously there's a number of different things that get mixed in there with baptisms and state meetings and bishops' youth discussions and they kind of find their way into that schedule on whatever day they fall on. So, yeah.
Now, this is just a random question that came to my mind, and it's nothing because you said anything other than your appointments you have. But I've noticed as I've talked with different bishops, they all sort of have a unique relationship with their executive secretary as far as how they use them, how they coordinate with them. How would you say you guys work together? Any tools you use to coordinate, other than maybe a calendar, but how does that dynamic go?
Yeah, so I think we work pretty well together. We use just like a Google calendar. So he has access to it and just kind of adds it. We kind of struggle. I don't mean struggle as we don't do it well, but we always talk about what kind of information he should be getting from the people, because it's helpful as a bishop to have at least some kind of an idea of what might be walking in the door in terms of an issue. So I think we kind of settled on just the question of, is there anything you'd like the bishop to know that you can kind of ponder and pray about before you meet with him? And sometimes I'll say, I'm struggling to make rent and kind of having some financial struggles, or they'll say, I prefer just to talk about it with him. Kind of make note of that, so I kind of know what it might be. Maybe it's a concern with the calling. So just so you're not getting blindsided. Sometimes they just don't want to give you information, and that's okay. You can handle those, and that's fine. But that's really it. I don't think anything really.
That's interesting. No, I love that that idea of just kind of prepping your executive secretary of saying when they call, here's some questions you can ask. And obviously there's a balance there because, there's certain questions that you don't want them to prying too much, or I need to know exactly what this is about before I can get you on the calendar. Obviously that wouldn't be appropriate, but I remember as Bishop, as I mentioned before, we're in pretty high welfare ward, all things considered. And we'd have service missionaries that if a person wanted to talk initially, most of these people I've never met before, they just kind of come out of the woodwork needing help. And so it was important that they met with the service missionary first. So I'd always have my executive secretary ask, is it a personal matter or is anything regarding finances? And sometimes people would sort of try and circumvent the system, but usually they say, yeah, it is about finances. And you say, great. Well, you first need to talk to this set of missionaries, service missionaries, and then they can help expedite this process. And a lot of times they'd say, oh, no, it's actually a temple recommend. And he'd say, oh, well, you can actually meet with a counselor since you've been in the ward a while. And anyways, I think that's a great tactic to just let the give the executive secretary some questions that they can ask so that you're – because any bishop knows, you got 4 appointments back to back. You get done with one and you're thinking, what is walking in next? And then sometimes, you don't know what it is and – you kind of buckle up and he says, well, I just needed an ecclesiastical endorsement. It's like, oh, okay, all right, we can do that. Let's do that real quick and we'll get you out the door. So it's nice to have a heads up.
Definitely.
Well, cool. John, this has been fantastic. I guess the other question, you've touched on this, any unique technologies or apps you use in your bishopric or ward council or that would be worth mentioning?
Not really. We I listened to one of your episodes a couple of weeks ago with a woman from Australia who I think it was LDSCollins.com. So We're helping to make that a success story in our ward. I just introduced it to our ward council on Sunday. I've looked through it, and it looks like a pretty neat tool, so I'll give a plug for that. Just get a calling request yesterday that came through text, so we're not quite on board yet. It was kind of a unique situation, so it's probably appropriate, but I'm hoping to really streamline the calling process. Up until this point, not really. I have counselors who are assigned to the different auxiliaries, and so they normally work through them to make the recommendations, which is fine, but I look forward to seeing how this works.
Cool. Well, Sean, it's always a pleasure to talk to a fellow Sacramento missionary, and that's right. We have a consensus here that it is the best mission. Great time there. And we love our mission president, as most people do. And I got to get him on one of these. I don't know if he'd go for that. But it would have to be a video one. Yeah. So he's so animated. Right. He's man, the things he taught me about faith is something I still hold on to for sure. But I appreciate the time you've taken. And as always, as you look back on your services at Elder Quorum president, a young men's president, and now a bishop, how's your service as a leader made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
Yeah, and I love listening to you. What a special experience to hear people's experiences as testimonies have been strengthened through their service. And, I remember I was called again at the kind of the beginning of October, and we had the tithing settlement that came up, and that we'd only been in the ward a couple of years, and so there were a lot of people I just didn't know. So I had an opportunity to get to know some people during that time. Really special experience. That's coming up now. I look forward to it. But I remember then, probably sometime in early January, sitting up on the stand, and I just kind of glanced down to the kind of front, my front left, and noticed a family in the ward and a specific trial that they had mentioned to me. And I just said, that poor family, that's such a difficult trial that they're facing. And then I moved back a row and I said, oh yeah, and that poor couple and the trial that they're facing. And it's just such a difficult thing to face. And then I realized I could go back row by row and recognize that every single person in one way or another was struggling with some kind of a trial, or whether it was death of a loved one, or financial issues, or a child who might be going astray, or whatever it might be. You realize, people really are just struggling, but they're here and they're trying and they're showing so much faith. And it taught me, helped me understand the responsibility that I have to really, and it was my first point that I made, to minister to the one. And I felt on a very small degree, how the Savior feels, as he knows each one of us so well. And as you get to know people and know who they are and their trials and also their triumphs and their successes as well, but you can really come to empathize with people. And I think that's such an important thing as a leader. And it's a weighty responsibility that bishops have, or anybody who has any kind of stewardship over people, to be able to minister to them. You realize that you stand as a representative of Christ, and that you should interact with them as well as you can, the way that the Lord would interact with them, and try to bless their lives the way that the Lord would have you bless their life. And in doing so, you witness miracles, some big, some small, some using a kind of off-quoted reference to Robert Bednar, but the tender mercies. You see those in people's lives and the way that the Lord just loves them and blesses them. And it can't help but strengthen your testimony of the Savior. And your testimony of priesthood keys, and as of the mantle that you have in whatever calling you might have. And it's really been an incredible experience for somebody who came with fairly inexperienced as it relates to the world and even church leadership. But to be able to feel the strength of the Spirit as you try your best to be an instrument in the hands of the Lord. It's just been an incredible experience to see that and to feel that strength.
That concludes my interview with Bishop Sean Hammond. Appreciate him taking some time to share those perspectives with us. I thought it was fantastic. A lot of gems in that one. And you know, he was saying something before the interview, kind of giving me feedback on what I mentioned, that it seems like I interview a lot of bishops, right? And I'd love to get more sisters involved. But he said, you know, maybe the bishops is sort of a more unique calling, that there isn't as, there's a lot more responsibility and a lot less training in these, on these topics that we discuss. And so he says he always appreciates hearing the ideas of other bishops. And that may be true, but if there is a leader out there, a primary president or a relief society president, and you feel like, no, you need just as much guidance, I would love to speak with you. Maybe you can connect me with somebody who is a fantastic leader in these callings. And really, at the end of the day, everybody's a fantastic leader in their own way. And I'm always kind of chuckled to myself when I invite someone to participate in a How I Lead interview and they say, oh, you know what? I have nothing to share. But not once have I done these interviews. I promise there's no interviews in my vault that I just have not shared because it was just two people talking and somebody saying, I don't know. Everybody has something to share and a unique approach they're taking to their calling. And the more we share it, the better leaders will be. I know I learn fantastic things. And if I am ever considered a decent leader, it is because I've had the opportunity of being the host that gets to answer all these or ask all these questions and learn from these leaders. So as always, I want to thank those that are helping Leading LDS keep the lights on and keep moving. If you haven't taken the time, please go to leadinglds.com/help and just consider some ways that you can contribute. Not all the ways are monetary ways. There's ways to contribute and even just be part of our Facebook group where we can talk about ideas and thoughts. And so until next time, be a leader and not a calling.